But these were mothers and fathers and sons and daughters who were wiped off the planet. And it's always been the youth that have led our movements, from stopping the war in Vietnam to civil rights. And now this is your time. Every one of you has a gift. What you do with it is your gift back. You are on the front lines of the most important fight of our life. Make it count. Make it count. Thank you.
Activists gather in D.C. to speak out on the real nuclear threat, and a new generation of civil rights leaders ask, does the Congressional Black Caucus support black people or corporations? All that and more coming up on the Ground. And welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital and the capital region here on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica Radio. I'm Esther Avarim. In our new time slot to end the week and kick off the weekend with voices of activists and activism. Well, today, a new generation of civil rights advocates question whether the Congressional Black Caucus is working for black people or for corporations. And while leaders of 50 nations gathered here last week to talk about the threat of nuclear terrorism, anti-nuclear forces say to the U.S. leaders, well, why not start with getting rid of the 15,000 existing nuclear weapons in the world? So as always, we have a lot for you in this hour, starting with our headlines. This week's unprecedented leak of the so-called Panama Papers reveal how much the rich and powerful use their tax havens to hide wealth. More than 11 million files were leaked from Mossack Fonseca, a law firm based in Panama. Some of the earliest headlines in Western media pointed to friends of Russian President Vladimir Putin, relatives of the prime ministers of Britain, Iceland, and Pakistan, and the president of Ukraine. Iceland's prime minister has stepped down after the leaked files revealed he and his wife were hiding investments worth millions of dollars behind a secretive offshore company. But as the week and story progressed, critics noted that no Americans were named so far in the files selected for scrutiny by the International Consortium for Investigative Journalists. WikiLeaks said that to avoid the appearance of select bias, the consortium could release all the files so the public can scrutinize the records for ourselves. Putin called the leak a CIA and imperialist effort, and the consortium said that the list of Americans implicated in the papers will be released next week. But author and activist Gerald Horn, this show's favorite geopolitical analyst, has a different take on the scandal. Good morning, Gerald. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
So is there more to this data leak from Mossack Fonseca than the corporate media is telling us?
Absolutely. That great sucking sound that you now hear is the sound of capital from all over the world being sucked into the United States and not necessarily going to Switzerland or Panama. Recall that a few years ago, the Brazilian leadership spoke of a currency war that had broken out. That is to say, countries competitively devaluing their currency in order to hype exports and gain more market share. That may not necessarily be accurate, but certainly what's going on right now is a capital war. That is to say, the attempt to attract more capital to your shores. And to that end, in recent years, the United States has waged a low-intensity war on Switzerland, for example, heretofore the favored site for offshore stashing of currency. Recall the controversy concerning the Swiss financial giant UBS. Now, Panama is in the crosshairs, and even though the United States has been trying to compel Panama to observe international rules concerning transparency, the United States itself has not followed those very same rules. Keep in mind that as capital flees China, now, instead of going to Switzerland or Panama, it most likely will come to the United States, which will give the United States a further stranglehold over the fate and destiny of the Chinese elite. Likewise, with regard to sanctions, that is to say the United States sanctioning countries like North Korea and Syria, rather than these countries trying to do business dealings through Panama or Switzerland, they may be compelled to come through the United States, which, of course, gives the United States a more leverage.
So I do know that as the story went on, a lot of the focus turned to these tax havens right here in the United States, like in Delaware and places that I didn't even realize were tax havens, like Wyoming and of course Nevada. So, but before we continue, it sounds like you're in a rotunda. I don't know if we hear like a big echo, like you're in a really big space, but I don't know if you can change that as we proceed. But what did you want to mention how these new tax havens might benefit from this focus on Mossack Fonseca?
Well, the states that you mentioned, such as Nevada and Wyoming and Delaware, are basically sites for establishing so-called shell corporations. With regard to banks, I think that South Florida and Miami will benefit.
I think we're losing you. Yeah, I think I was encouraging him to go to a quieter space, and he was on the move, and we may have lost him. So, what we were trying to talk about is how, as this story has progressed, the Consortium of International Journalists started to say that they would release the names of Americans or those, you know, based here in the U.S. Those names will be put out next week. But in the meantime, the list seemed to be lacking Americans. I think we have Gerald back.
Yes, I am back.
Okay. Sorry. All right. So, but you were saying, pick up what you were saying.
What I was saying is that Miami and the Miami banks will probably benefit from this attack on Panama and Switzerland. And keep in mind that this is nothing new. Recall that the real estate boom in South Florida was fueled in the 1980s by drug money going into Miami banks, which pumped up the real estate market. I dare say that you'll see a repeat of that trend, this time with foreign capital coming into South Florida banks. Keep in mind as well that banks are moving to negative interest rates. That is to say that instead of you putting your money in a bank and they give you 3% or 4% interest, what happens is that trend is reversed. You now have to pay them to keep your money. And with the banks having more money than they know what to do with, most likely it will fuel a speculative boom leading to the inevitable bust and a return to the Great Recession-type conditions of 2008.
So what do you think about the, I guess, charges or claims by WikiLeaks and I think some Russian media that I've heard that this leak of this data so far has been very slanted to support the type of movement you're talking about, that it's been very much slanted toward supporting the U.S. and not really focusing on what's happening here?
Well, that's certainly a credible charge, but the journalists involved could credibly argue that they were leaked millions of documents, and it takes more than a nanosecond to go through millions of documents. And I dare say, and I hope, that another shoe will drop within coming days and weeks, which will inevitably reveal the culpability of U.S. nationals in the scandal.
And finally, how does this affect kind of like just the average person, those of us who don't have, you know, these kind of secret accounts and don't really have those kinds of resources? What kind of impact does this have on us and our lives and I guess even our economy here?
Well, we're talking about tax avoidance. And if billionaires are avoiding paying taxes, that means either A, people like yourself and myself and our audience will have to pay more taxes, or B, less taxes will be collected and programs like education and healthcare will be cut. This scandal has everything to do with our day-to-day lives.
Okay. Well, before you go, I want listeners to know that you'll be here in D.C. next Friday and Saturday, April 15th in Baltimore at Red Emma's, and Saturday the 16th at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe here in D.C. So congratulations on the launch of your two latest books, Confronting Black Jacobins, which we've talked about on this show, and also Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary.
Well, thank you very much, and I look forward to seeing you and your audience next Friday and Saturday in Baltimore and Washington.
Okay, great. Thank you, Gerald.
Thank you.
Okay, so now police criminal justice reform are the subject of several events and actions in the region this week. In addition to rallies yesterday in Baltimore and Annapolis, there were programs at George Washington University and at the University of District of Columbia. At UDC, there was a discussion and debate on criminal justice reform and reinvestment. Chantel James has more.
About 50 concerned citizens met in a town hall-style meeting to discuss criminal justice reforms and justice reinvestment. Students in the UDC Criminal Justice Program gave presentations on their research in the area of criminal justice reform. Deputy City Administrator Kevin Donahue spoke on trends in crimes over the past 2 decades, while City Council Chairperson Phil Mendelson spoke on preventative measures for crime.
If you think about it, the criminal justice system is basically a reactive system. But if you think a little bit harder or a little bit longer, there are very few ways that with criminal justice that we can be proactive. But there are a few ways. The first way is by improving our ability to close cases. If we're better about closing cases and then prosecuting effectively, so not just closing the case and figuring out that Joe shot Sam, but actually convicting Joe for shooting Sam, it does have a proactive effect because a lot of crime is committed by repeat offenders. And so if we get that person, we get them locked up, we either keep them off the streets, everybody's safer, but it also means that we can address Joe's issues and make it less likely that he or she will reoffend.
After the presentations, there was a lively question and answer in which victims of the drug war spoke in favor of the council's recent moves to decriminalize marijuana. This is Chantel James for On the Ground, signing off.
Police reform in particular was the mission of the crowds who rallied yesterday and last night under the hashtag Baltimore Still Rising in support of legislation currently being considered by the Maryland General Assembly that would overhaul the state's controversial Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, which currently, for example, gives police officers 10 full days before they can be even questioned in cases when the officer has killed or brutalized someone. The Baltimore Sun reported this week that the legislation could be imperiled because of a disagreement over a provision in the proposed legislation that would require a civilian be placed on boards that review cases of police misconduct. A broad coalition, including activist organizations, including Progressive Maryland and the American Civil Liberties Union Maryland, labor unions and faith leaders are advocating for the reforms, and you can listen to our past coverage of the reform effort on our website, onthegroundshow.org. The Maryland General Assembly adjourns on Monday. Next week will mark the second anniversary of nearly 300 girls in Nigeria being kidnapped by the extremist organization Boko Haram. The abductions sparked a global Bring Back Our Girls campaign, and here in D.C., the effort was spearheaded by Omolola Adela Oso, who organized a rally outside the Nigerian embassy. Act for Accountability has remained steadfast, joining millions across the globe in calling for the rescue of the missing girls and all current Boko Haram abductees. On Wednesday, her organization, and that's Omolola Adela Oso's organization, Act for Accountability, is holding a fundraiser at the Pepco Edison Place Gallery, 702 8th Street in Northwest D.C., to benefit displaced children in Nigeria.
Anniversary week is Hope Endures. And this is a collective, you know, decision from not just the Bring Back Our Girls group in Abuja that continue to have sit-ins every day, but all of us that have chapters, you know, of the movement in New York and D.C., that we didn't want this to be an angry anniversary, but we also don't want it to be a somber anniversary, because the families of these girls still say they have hope. And so, you know, hope endures, and that's what we should stand on. So we stand hopeful, but in standing hopeful, we also have to stand firm and tell the truth.
The Internally Displaced Monitoring Center reports that as a result of Boko Haram and other conflicts in northern Nigeria, an estimated 3.3 million Nigerians have been internally displaced, and at least another 250,000 have taken refuge in neighboring Chad, Niger, and Cameroon. These are the highest numbers of displaced persons in Africa, surpassing South Sudan and just behind Colombia and Syria. The most alarming part, 58% of the IDP population are children, children in need of basic necessities, health care, and education. Again, the fundraiser at the Pepco Edison Place Gallery, 702 8th Street in Northwest DC, is next Wednesday evening to benefit displaced children in Nigeria. And Omolola's organization is Act for Accountability with the number four, for four. Okay. And finally, Black Millennials for Flint is holding their No Lead Zone Old School Pajama Jam tonight from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. And this fundraiser event is bringing together eight African-American not-for-profits, business owners, and it's taking place at an African-American-owned venue, the Spice Suite, 6902 4th Street in Northwest D.C. That's 6902 4th Street in Northwest D.C. And 100% of the proceeds will go to the Community Foundation of Greater Flint's Flint Child Health Development Fund. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, we'll be on the ground for a world without nuclear weapons, the original weapons of mass destruction. Stay with us.
Now tell me why you don't kidnap my sister, eh? If I do the same, make you think I'm, eh? If I do the same to a brother like you, you know, say I will go gas on another man. Tell me why you go bomb blast the park, my G. Same place my mama, they stack my feet. Same place that they get my food to feed. But I tell me why you do me like that. Oh, they pain me, they pain me. They pain me, they pain me. But I, they pain me, they pain me. They pain all of us. Oh, they pain everybody. Yeah. Once upon a time, during the days of Jaguar. Oh, my beautiful Naija. Naija, Naija. Oh, my beautiful Naija. So sorry. Shay, if you bomb Nepal, we go see light. And if you kill a man, does it feel right? A fake soldier come a village in a daylight. We spray all the mama them one by one. My beautiful Nigeria, me not get you no more. Me not get you no more. Me not get you no more.
So while leaders of 50 nations gathered here last weekend to talk about the threat of nuclear terrorism, anti-nuclear activists organized by Global Zero said to those leaders, well, why not start with getting rid of the 15,000 existing nuclear weapons? Those weapons are primarily in the hands of the United States and Russia. Here are voices from the Global Zero rally held at McPherson Square with a four-story high inflated replica of a nuclear missile in the background. And they were right in downtown D.C. Here are their voices.
Right, to demand that the world leaders at the Nuclear Security Summit, just a couple blocks away from us, step up to the plate and eliminate nuclear weapons. We're here to demand zero. Woo! And with that said, I am here to introduce our first speaker, Mr. Joel Rubin. Joel is formerly with the State Department in the Plowshares Fund. He is an expert on Middle Eastern issues and played a pivotal role in both the Iran deal and the New START treaty. He is a great advocate for nuclear disarmament, and I'm happy to welcome him to the stage.
Wow, fantastic. Sun just came out. Look what you guys did. All right. So how many of you feel secure today because we have 15,000 nuclear weapons? How many of you would feel more secure if we got rid of them all? All right. There you go. Having nuclear weapons does not create security. Let's all say that again. Having nuclear weapons does not create security. You know what else doesn't create security? Spending $1 trillion over the next 3 decades to modernize nuclear weapons. Think about that, $1 trillion. And there's going to be more than that. That's $1 trillion we're not spending on roads, on schools, on housing, on taking care of the homeless, on ensuring Social Security is there for good. That's $1 trillion that we're not going to spend on the weapons we need to fight against terrorism, which we do need to. That's $1 trillion going to fight wars that we've already won. The Cold War is over. We do not need to be fighting that. Now, there are two different visions right now we're hearing in our politics about the kind of future we're going to have. One of the visions is about carpet bombing, It's about torture. It's about building walls. Boo, that's right. There's another vision, and that's our vision here together, our collective vision. It's about engaging people. It's about building partnerships. It's about peace, and it's about diplomacy to resolve the tough issues. And there are tough issues. But I'll tell you what. Ripping up our security alliances in Asia and in Europe will do nothing to make us safer. They will only make us weaker and create dangers. Just the other day, one of the leading presidential candidates, Donald Trump, said that he would be okay with countries in Asia acquiring nuclear weapons. Who agrees with Donald Trump? No. He also opposed the Iran nuclear deal. Ted Cruz opposes the Iran nuclear deal. On day one, if elected, they say that they're going to rip that up. What's that going to do? That's going to tell Iran that it does not have any path forward, and they're going to go for the bomb. And then we're going to have an arms race in the Middle East. Do we want an arms race in the Middle East? No. What we want is security and safety. We want to roll back the spending on nuclear weapons. We want to support diplomacy to deal with the threats that we're facing. We want to keep our allies together. We don't want hate. We want peace. And that's why you're here. You are playing a crucial role in all of this. If your voices are not speaking out, those other voices are speaking out. And that's all the politicians pay attention to. Who is speaking out? Quiet from our side ensures that the other side will win. Are you going to be quiet?
No!
Are you going to be quiet?
No!
I'm so glad you're here. Washington is glad you're here. We need you here. Thank you, everybody, for what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Joel. All right, next up we have Dr. Vincent Intondi. Vin is a great friend and supporter of Global Zero. He is the Director of Research at American University's Nuclear Studies Institute. He's an Associate Professor of History at Montgomery College, and he also is the author of a book called African Americans Against the Bomb. So please join me in welcoming Vin.
Thank you. Now, when Lily asked me to speak here today, I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to say to you guys. And 2 days ago, I spoke with Coco Kondo, the famous atomic bomb survivor and a dear friend of mine. I told her I was going to be here today. But she said, whatever you say, just make sure that those young activists at Global Zero know how important they are. First time I went to Hiroshima, I was much like your age, a student. And I was there with American University's Nuclear Studies Institute, and we partner with Ritsumeikan University. And the bonding experience you have with Japanese students is incredible as you see ceremonies in museums and talk to survivors. But the moment that hit me the hardest was what's called the Lantern Ceremony that occurs on every night of August 6th, where thousands of people gather at a very famous river where so many died in 1945. And that first time I was there, I was with my new Japanese friends, and as we were going through the line to make our floating paper lantern, everything hit me, and what I had seen all week, what I imagined what they had been through. And as we put that lantern in the water, I still remember the message I wrote, which was, I will dedicate every day of my life to making sure this never happens again. And I saw the flicker of that light, and it broke down. I started sobbing, and I started asking for forgiveness and saying I'm sorry for what we had done. My Japanese friends were crying, saying it's not your fault, and look what we did to China. And Coco, the survivor, was on the top of a bank, and she swooped down to console me. And she said, these kids will never forget this moment and the impact you had. But now you have an obligation. You must go back to the United States and reach people one at a time and make sure this never happens again. Now, the Hibakusha, the atomic bomb survivors, are amazing people. They truly deserve the Nobel Peace Prize. But they are dying. They are getting so old now. The average age is 80. So many that speak to my students every year are no longer with us. And they are scared. They are scared that when they die, this issue will be forgotten. And nobody will carry on their message of never again. Because so often, we forget about the human element in nuclear weapons. We focus on the cost, the politics, the academics of it. But these were mothers and fathers and sons and daughters who were wiped off the planet. And it's always been the youth that have led our movements, from stopping the war in Vietnam to civil rights. And now this is your time. Every one of you has a gift. What you do with it is your gift back. You are on the front lines of the most important fight of our life. Make it count. Make it count. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. All right. I am so pleased to introduce a Global Zero activist named Emily Volgamore. Yeah! Emily is a Global Zero Action Corps leader and a junior at the University of New Hampshire. She's come all the way down for Global Zero's activist training this weekend and to speak at this rally. Over the last year, Emily has done a lot of amazing stuff. She's built a group of Global Zero activists at University of New Hampshire, lobbied her senators on the Iran deal, and spoken to a bunch of presidential candidates about the issue of nuclear weapons, which I think we all know is very important. So please join me in welcoming Emily. Hi, everyone. It's so good to see everyone here. I'm going to be honest with you. About a year ago, I joined Global Zero for the sheer fact that I pretty much knew nothing about nuclear weapons, and that scared me. The fact that I learned about nuclear weapons in a textbook high school chapter of the Cold War and then closed it, and then thought they didn't exist today, was something that I couldn't imagine only applied to me. Our message here today is to educate every single person that this is a real threat. We hear about things like the Green Movement, all these social activist movements happening all over the world, yet we don't hear about the one thing that threatens all of those. Anything we care about, our family, our friends, our jobs, doesn't matter if we have a nuclear mishap. Every single person here today has some sort of cause that the $1 trillion we are looking to spend on nuclear weapons can go towards. I can't imagine spending $1 trillion when there's teachers that could use a better pay raise, when there's women that could use equal rights in pay, when our ozone is depleting at a rate we never thought we would ever see. Yet we are looking to further extend our threat. Today we have the power to use social media, to use conversation, to talk about these things so this becomes a household topic. The more we talk about this, the more people will act. It is our time to think about what we want to spend $1 trillion on and start speaking loudly. Thank you so much. Wow. Emily's pretty awesome, huh?
Yeah.
And let's see, last but not least, I would like to welcome Global Zero's own Global Campaign Director, Meredith Horowski, to the stage. As our Global Campaign Director, Meredith is responsible for our global field strategy and basically every mobilization we do. She has played a key role in Global Zero's kind of field power and building it up across the United States and India and Pakistan. And I'm so happy we have her. So without further ado, Meredith Horowski.
Hello, D.C. Hello, Mr. Square. How you guys doing? Thank you all so much for coming out on this beautiful April Fool's Day. You being here is so important. Showing everyone who has eyes on Washington, D.C. right now, that is heads of states, that is national press, that is the international community, that we have a message for them. As you heard today, just blocks away, leaders from more than 50 countries are getting together to talk about nuclear security. President Obama has wrangled them all together for his fourth and final nuclear security summit. They're sitting down to chat about how they can take steps to prevent nuclear terrorism. Now, this is a really important topic, a really critical one. Nuclear terrorism is one of the most urgent threats facing us today. We all know that if ISIS and other terrorist groups
get their hands on enough nuclear material to acquire a dirty bomb, the devastation that we have seen in Paris, in Brussels, in Beirut, in San Bernardino is going to pale in comparison to what will happen then. And they're not far from it. So the leaders, meeting just a few blocks away, to address that threat, to address nuclear terrorism, have one really, really glaring omission. They're not talking at all. They are completely ignoring the 15,000 nuclear weapons in the world today. The 15,000 monstrosities like the one right behind me. So, this is a nuclear security summit aimed at preventing a nuclear catastrophe that doesn't address nuclear weapons. I really wish this were an April Fool's joke, but I swear it's not, and that's horrifying. What's more, this summit is brought to us by a president who 7 years ago won a Nobel Peace Prize for his commitment to seek the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons. And he said how he would do it. He would bring together countries from all nuclear weapon states to make it happen. Well, he has got most of them in the room today, and they're certainly not talking about reducing their nuclear arsenals. So we have a message for him. President Obama, this one is way below your pay grade. So we're here with a message to these world leaders who have lost sight of the real threat. We haven't. And we're here with our four-story inflatable nuclear missile to put that threat right back in their sights. We need to make sure that they hear us loud and clear. Because 15,000 nuclear weapons does not equal security. There is no such thing as security. Well, we have thousands of those weapons on hair trigger alert, ready to be fired at a moment's notice. There's no such thing as security while terrorists are working every single day to buy or steal a nuclear weapon. There's no such thing as security while we are spending $1 trillion investing in our nuclear arsenal, taking money away from the things that actually keep us safe. There's no such thing as security while we're one cyber hack away from our last half an hour. And there's no such thing as security while we cling to the weapons that are designed to wipe cities like this one completely off the map. So we can do better. Say it with me. We can do better.
We can do better.
We can do better. So the Nuclear Security Summit, to be fair, this is the right format. It's bringing together the right leaders for actionable plans. But this is the wrong agenda. We need to shift the conversation to the things that actually threaten our security every single day. Nuclear weapons. And this is not a pie-in-the-sky dream. If they can do the Nuclear Security Summit, they can get together to talk about nukes, to talk about verifiable plans for zero. But it's not going to happen until we make it happen. And that starts here with us today, sending a clear message to these leaders that if they don't want to talk about this, we will. If they don't want to address the real threat, we will. And we're not going to stop until we get to zero, and with your help, we will. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, you just heard voices from the recent rally organized by Global Zero to advocate for the elimination of nuclear weapons. And that was as the Nuclear Security Summit was underway here in D.C. Thank you to Lydia Curtis for her reporting at the rally. This is On the Ground on 89.3 WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. I'm Esther Averam. When we come back, a new generation of civil rights advocates question whether the Black Congressional Caucus is working for Black people or for corporations. We'll be speaking with Rashad Robinson of Color of Change.
How can I say? Love them.
Welcome back to On the Ground on 89.3 WPFW. I'm still Esther Averam. Well, one oddity, something personally distressing to me, has been the fact that African Americans, particularly in the South, have created this so-called firewall for Hillary Clinton, a candidate that many progressives credit for a host of neoliberal ills, you know, the corporatization of the Democratic Party, mass incarceration, the destruction of the poverty social safety net, the destruction of Glass-Steagall under her husband's administration, and that destruction led to the global financial meltdown in 2008. So in the early weeks of the presidential primaries, when Clinton reached this firewall, the good black folks of South Carolina, another thing happened that same week. The Congressional Black Caucus, actually it turned out the Congressional Black Caucus Political Action Committee endorsed Hillary Clinton. And then many of us learned for the first time that such a PAC exists and that it was supposedly separate from the elected body, the elected members of Congress, and filled with a majority of corporate lobbyists, some representing companies that harm African-American communities. There was actually a really good article by David Dayen in the New Republic, and he's talked about some of these industries directly targeting black communities, whether through mass incarceration or the subprime lending crisis, or opposing the fight for 15, believe it or not. So with me to talk about the CBC, the CBC PAC, and the black community is Rashad Robinson, executive director of the human rights, civil rights organization, Color of Change. Welcome back to the show, Rashad. We have him? Okay. All right. So that, very good piece in the, while we try to get Rashad, that long piece in the New Republic, it talked about this relationship, and this is one of the pieces about the corporations in that article. It says, despite the long history of the Congressional Black Caucus as an unbought collection of socially conscious leaders, these extreme efforts to buy influence cannot help but have an impact. In recent years, CBC members have joined with Republicans to repeatedly undermine Dodd-Frank financial rules. Others have been accused of shilling for for-profit colleges. Still others form the backbone of the fight against the eventually passed net neutrality rules. Color of Change focused on the CBC PAC because of the makeup of its 21-member board of directors, which decides political endorsements. Only 8 of those directors are elected CBC members. The other 13 include 2 employees of the PAC and 11 corporate lobbyists. As Li Fang laid out last month in The Intercept, these lobbyists represent dozens of firms, including student loan servicer Navient, routinely accused of violating consumer protection laws, Laurelin Tobacco, manufacturer of Newport cigarettes, Dirty Energy Utilities, Entergy and Energy Future Holdings, and Purdue Pharmaceuticals, maker of OxyContin, and perhaps as responsible as any company for the opiate epidemic. The PAC, which has raised $2.7 million since 2010, gets its funding from the biggest firms in America, like telecoms AT&T and Comcast, payday lender Cash America, megabanks J.P. Morgan Chase and Citigroup, and minimum wage foe, the National Restaurant Association, and private prison firm Corrections Corporation of America. So, wow, that's a mouthful. And that was actually talking about how it seems the members of the CBC have also been compromised, and it's not just the lobbyists that are part of the PAC. Well, I think we have Rashad Robinson now. Good morning, Rashad.
Good morning. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for talking so early from the West Coast today. So let's jump right in. One of your current campaigns is Tell the CBC Corporations Don't Speak for Black People. So tell us about what initiated that campaign and the impact of that corporate heavy focus of the CBC PAC.
Well, like you said in your opening, you know, what we saw was an announcement of an endorsement for Hillary and a non-endorsement for Donna Edwards. And then we started to dig in, and as news stories started to come out about the makeup of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC, about the lobbyists on the PAC and the decision-making power they have. In fact, more lobbyists on the PAC than actually members, elected members of the Congressional Black Caucus, we started to dig in deeper and started to find the connection that those lobbyists actually had, connections to all the industries you just laid out. in many ways, this really goes back to a problem at Color of Change that we consistently find ourselves fighting, and it's this idea of civil rights washing, wrapping dangerous policies in a cloak of support from black gatekeepers, and allowing these corporations to sort of get a pass on the dirty or nefarious things that they do because they're connected or have or situated next to civil rights institutions or institutions that have moral authority. And we have got to stop that. It's this idea of having presence without power. It's being in the room but actually still being on the menu. And the fact that these lobbyists for big tobacco, lobbyists for student loan giants, lobbyists for corporations that, you know, lobby on guns, are able to make decisions on who gets the moral seal, the moral authority seal, the conscience of the Congress seal from black folks should trouble all of us.
You know, how significant to you was the decision of the CBC PAC to endorse Hillary Clinton or the decision not to endorse Donna Edwards?
I think it came at a very important and critical time in the cycle. I think you laid out very clearly the fact that we were heading into a firewall moment. But I also think that if the Congressional Black Caucus had just been honest about who they are, that would have been better. But unfortunately, the press conference that they had, they rolled out a whole bunch of members of the Congressional Black Caucus, not members of the Congressional Black Caucus board. And actually, for hours, news media listed the endorsement as the Congressional Black Caucus makes these endorsements,
right,
not the Congressional Black Caucus PAC. In fact, when you saw the press conference, you saw nowhere behind the podium the lobbyist board members who actually made the decision about the endorsement. And so, in fact, that is the idea of civil rights washing. It's presenting us one image that this has got the seal of approval from black folks or for civil rights, and when in fact, there's a Geppetto behind the Pinocchio. And that was the message behind our campaign. It was that either be very clear and remake your name or change your board and stop taking money from, you know, all of these industries that put us in harm's way. In fact, industries that we send members of Congress to from our communities to fight.
Whoa. I think that we're losing you again, Rashad. We're going to try and get him back again.
I'm here.
Oh, there he is. Okay, all right. Go ahead. We hear you.
No, and I was just saying, you know, industries that we send our members of Congress to fight.
Right. Yeah. So it seems like the PAC is able to hide behind this historic progressive legacy of the CBC. But I'm wondering, you know, I was just reading how it seems like CBC members themselves have been compromised. You know, are our representatives we're sending to, are these people still progressive? Are they still fighting for us? Or it just seems like based on the list I just read, they're fighting very often against our own interests.
Well, I mean, this is why this type of information and these type of campaigns are important, because without elevating and providing the visibility, providing the sunlight in areas of darkness, then we actually don't know. And we can't expect everyday people to always have all this information. And so part of why we wanted to run this campaign is because we wanted to make sure that this was coming to light. And as the news stories and as reporters have started to dig in, we've actually had to hear some of the responses from some of the members of Congress. We've listened to G.K. Butterfield, the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, defend the lobbyists on the board. In fact, he defended Al Wynn's role on the board when Al Wynn was defeated in his congressional race by Donna Edwards,
right,
and had to leave Congress. He went directly to go lobby for the tobacco industry. And in defending his role on the Congressional Black Caucus board, and defending him actually being able to vote to decide whether or not to give someone who defeated him in the race an endorsement, he said G.K. Butterfield said that Al Wynn brings an important perspective in defending menthol cigarettes, that a lot of African-Americans smoke menthol. And then if you want to ban cigarettes altogether, maybe you should, but we need the perspective of the menthol cigarette industry on the Congressional Black Caucus Board.
Do they have any anti-tobacco advocates on the board, too?
no anti-tobacco advocates on the board, but we need menthol cigarette perspectives making a decision about whether or not these candidates get the seal of approval. Menthol cigarettes. I mean, these are the responses that we're getting. It shows, and then we hear other comments. We heard Gregory Meeks, who runs the actual Congressional Black Caucus Board. We heard him talk about that.
He's a representative from New York, right?
Representative from New York. And he talked about how folks take off their hat when they walk at these lobbyists. You know, they take off their lobbyist hat when they walk at the room and they just want to be supportive. Now, I know a lot of lobbyists, and I think that I know lobbyists who are good people, and this is not to say that all lobbyists are bad people, but to say that they completely take off the hat of the job that's paying them every single day, and they walk into the room, and there's some sort of firewall, and there's a firewall actually without no clear policy. There's no clear policy the CBC PAC has about firewalls. So when they were voting on Donna Edwards, Al Wynn was sitting in the room and involved in the discussion. And so, these answers that these members of Congress have given to questions about the integrity of their process and their answers and responses shows that they actually haven't been paying attention to what's happened the last 30 and 40 years. And the way that the foxes have gotten into the chicken coops and have made life for black people incredibly hard. You talked about the role of corporate power and banks and all the things that have happened inside the Democratic Party. That's when we need the powerful voice of black folks. That's when we need the powerful voice of our black members speaking truth to power and pushing back against industries that put us in harm's way. And if we have a path of giving seal of approval to congressional candidates, and while their board may have a couple of members of Congress elected, the majority come from, you know, private corporate industries, that has to be remade. And so that's why we launched this campaign. That's why we're pushing it. That's why we're urging people who are listening to join us in this. We also know how this hurts and damages the image of good members of Congress who are going there to speak truth to power, to fight back. And so we've got to do this. We've got to do this work if we want to make sure that we can hold people on the right accountable. We also have to hold people on the left.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about the influence on, I guess, what happens to corporations and the benefits that corporations might get. But how about in terms of policy? I think one of the things I read in the New Republic article, very good article, what talked about, for example, you know, how the net neutrality fight, for example, and how so many members of the CBC stood on the side of these big telecoms. But when you look at the election right now, for example, and you see so many of the black political leaders, members of Congress, et cetera, lined up on the side of Hillary Clinton, it seems to me that this is the same kind of blind eye toward policy. So how can they just line up behind Hillary Clinton given her policies toward, you know, fracking, the environment, the, you know, taking money from the pharmaceutical industry, from the oil industry, and, you know, just, you know, of course, the whole mass incarceration controversy around her husband's presidency.
You know, I think that's why a board like Congressional Black Caucus PAC board should be free from those type of influences. So even if we disagreed with their decision to endorse Hillary Clinton, or if they made an endorsement over here that we disagree with, that we can look at the process and feel confident that at least there was some integrity to the process. At Color of Change, we haven't made an endorsement in the presidential race, but we watched, like many, in horror as the former president made those comments yesterday in shouting down Black Lives Matter protesters. Black Lives Matter protesters who have made this political moment that we're in and helped us elevate conversations that this country did not want to have. And we also watched when the Congressional Black Caucus PAC made their endorsement of Hillary Clinton, and journalists pushed them around generational divides. And we watched as black members of Congress stood up there and actually criticized young protesters and said that they didn't sort of understand the process. They didn't understand how things work. Mm-hmm. And I think people are protesting not because they don't understand how things work. People are protesting because they do understand how things work. And people have understood for far too long they have not worked for black people. They have not worked in our interest. And just having black faces in high places without actually having accountability and power will never serve us long term.
You know, when I think this was actually during the continued attack on Gaza, there were a number of activists here locally who called out the CBC for their continued support to give aid to the Israeli military. And at the same time, there, I don't know if it was linked, but there was also legislation at that time that was continuing to funnel this military hardware to police departments around the country. And there was a lot of criticism, some demonstrations outside where the CBC was meeting, you know, some gatherings they were having. And to me, that was kind of an early indication that, well, it was an early indication, you know, in the Black Lives Matter movement that there was often no support for some of the issues that the Black Lives Matter movement was advocating for.
Yeah, and I think what you're seeing is that we are inside of a very unique and important political movement. And we have many black members of Congress who are actually not interested in anything that's transformative. They're interested in business as usual. They're interested in continuing to solidify and keep in place the rules that got them into positional power. And I say it's positional power because it's not real power. It's power that sits beside and is connected to corporate power. And if we don't do anything to, you know, undo corporate political structures, if we don't do anything to build the type of people power campaigns that force decision makers to do the right thing, then we actually will never do anything transformative for black folks. And so simply being in the room, simply having what may feel like a voice at the table without any real power will not serve us long term. And so, you know, as we dug in deeper to the ways in which this political pack has operated, you know, this campaign felt like something that we had to do. And I have to say that these type of campaigns are never easy for us. It's never the kind of easy slam dunk thing to have to step out and engage on issues and fight people that you feel like you should be on the same side as. There are so many folks on the other side of issues or far on the other side that we feel like we have to fight. But how do we have the type of moral authority to push Hillary Clinton around private prison donations, which we've been doing? We've been pushing her around private prison donations and forced her campaign to give back some private prison money. How do we do that? And then the Congressional Black Caucus PAC is taking private prison money. How do we not say something about that? And so we recognize that will be ways in which donors may walk away from us. There may be ways in which we don't get invited to certain meetings, but we have to understand that the reason for existing as a civil rights organization is sometimes to speak truth to not just the comfortable issues, but sometimes the uncomfortable
ones. You know, when you were talking, it reminded me of a recent article I read that talked about not only the power of the Clinton machine and within the electoral arena in terms of them kind of building up these long-term relationships with people, supporting down-ticket candidates in not only in Congress, but on the state level, on the local level. You know, my city, I'm from Philadelphia, and I get really sick every time I see Michael Nutter, the mayor. You know, he's up there, you know, shilling for Hillary, what I consider shilling for Hillary Clinton. But the article was talking about how they are also powerful in the not-for-profit world, that this Clinton Foundation controls so much money and controls so many other pockets of money that not only are politicians kind of cowed by them, but also not-for-profit organizations. And so your stand and your ability to speak truth to power is really very courageous. And I commend you for that because, you know, this kind of, you know, it's a company town and, you know, we need voices like yours, like Color of Change, willing to speak truth to power. So we are kind of out of time, but I want to know if you have any last comments.
Well, I just urge people to visit colorofchange.org, follow us on Twitter and Facebook, sign the petitions on this issue and the other things that we're working on. We need the support and engagement and voices of people who believe that these are the type of fights that we must have for the future of our country, the fights to hold corporate and government accountable and to build real power for everyday people.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rashad Robinson, Executive Director of Color of Change. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
And that will do it for us on the Ground. I'm Esther Avaram. Also, special thanks to author and activist Gerald Horn, Omolola Adeleoso of Act for Accountability and Bring Back Our Girls. Again, Rashad Robinson of Color of Change. Thanks to Chantel James for her reporting at UDC and Lydia Curtis for her reporting at Global Zero, the Global Zero Rally. Thanks to Michael Byfield, DJ Wahid, and thanks to our engineer, Mike Nasella. And thank you so much for listening. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Please be in touch with us if you'd like to intern or contribute and to learn digital or radio media. Now stay tuned for the next hour when I will take your story of the week during Friday's open mic edition of Community Watch and Comment. Raise your voice. Peace.